I'm going to read from the Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 7, text number 1, called Knowledge of the Absolute. Sri Bhagavan Gacha Maya Satam Raparta Yogam Yun Janvana Shaya Asam Shayam Samgramam Yata Gyasasi Tatsprinu. Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Now hear, O son of Pritha, how by practicing yoga in full consciousness of me, with mind attached to me, you can know me in full, free from doubt." Purport. In the seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita, the nature of Krishna consciousness is fully described. Krishna is full in all opulences, and how he manifests such opulences is described herein. Also, four kinds of fortunate people who become attached to Krishna, and four kinds of unfortunate people who never take to Krishna are described in this chapter. In the first six chapters of Bhagavad Gita, the living entity has been described as non-material spirit soul, capable of elevating himself to self-realization by different kinds of types of yogas. At the end of the sixth chapter, it has been clearly stated that the steady concentration of the mind upon Krishna, or in other words, Krishna consciousness, is the highest form of all yogas. By concentrating one's mind upon Krishna, one is able to know the absolute truth completely, but not otherwise. In personal Brahmajyoti or localized Paramatma realization, is not perfect knowledge of the absolute truth because it is partial. Full and scientific knowledge is Krishna, and everything is revealed to the person in Krishna consciousness. In complete Krishna consciousness, one knows that Krishna is ultimate knowledge beyond any doubts. Different types of yoga are only stepping stones on the path of Krishna consciousness. One who takes directly to Krishna consciousness automatically knows about Brahmajyoti and Paramatma in full. By practice of Krishna conscious yoga, one can know everything in full, namely the absolute truth, the living entities, material nature, and their manifestations with paraphernalia. One should therefore begin yoga practice as directed in the last verse of the sixth chapter. Concentration of the mind upon Krishna, the Supreme, is made possible by prescribed devotional service in 9 different forms, of which Shravanam is the first and most important. The Lord therefore says to Arjuna, "Tatsprinu," or "Hear for me." No one can be a greater authority than Krishna, and therefore by hearing from him, one receives the greatest opportunity to become a perfectly Krishna conscious person. One has therefore to learn from Krishna directly, or from a pure devotee of Krishna, and not from a non-devotee upstart puffed up with academic education. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, this process of understanding Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Absolute Truth, is described in the second chapter of the first canto as follows. Srinvatam svakata Krishna punya shravana kirtana vridyantaksto yavajani vidunoti saritsatam nashta prayesh pavadreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya Bhagavatu tamashloke bhaktir bhavati naishtiki tadara jastamo bhava kama loba deyastriye cheta etana vidam spitam satve prasidati evam prasanamanaso bhagavat bhakti yogataha bhagavatatva vijnanam mukta sangasya jayate vidyante ridya granti stityante sarvasamshaya Shriyante Chatsikaramani Drista Evatmani Shre. To hear about Krishna from Vedic literatures or to hear from him directly through the Bhagavad Gita is itself righteous activity. And for one who hears about Krishna, Lord Krishna, who is dwelling in everyone's heart, acts as the best wishing friend, and purifies the devotee who constantly engages in hearing of him. In this way, a devotee naturally develops his dormant transcendental knowledge. As he hears more about Krishna from the Bhagavatam and from the devotees, he becomes fixed in the devotional service of the Lord. By the development of devotional service, one becomes free from the modes of passion and ignorance, and thus material lusts and avarice should diminish. When these impurities are wiped away, the candidate remains steady in his position of pure goodness, becomes enlivened by devotional service, and understands the science of God perfectly. Thus bhakti yoga severs the hard knot of material affection, enables one to come at once to the state of a samshayam, samagram, understanding of the Supreme Absolute Truth, Personality of Godhead. The Bhagavatam 1:2:17-21. Therefore, only by hearing from Krishna or from his devotee in Krishna consciousness will one understand the science of Krishna. Sri Bhagavan Vacha Maya Sattamanakparta Yoga Munja Manashaya Asamnam Samagramam Yata Yasasi Tat Srinu. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Now hear, O son of Pritha, how by practicing yoga in full consciousness of me, with mind attached to me, you can know me in full, free from doubt." Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthagate Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Tadavane Namaste Sarasvatam Deve Gauravani Vicharane Nirvishesha Srinivadi Pasikatya Adeya Siddharana. This begins the middle six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita can be divided into three different parts. The first six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita is who Prabhupada says here, that the different types of yoga systems are explained by which one can become qualified to practice devotional service. And in the middle six chapters, pure devotional service is explained. In the last six chapters, the knowledge by which will fix us in pure devotional service is explained. And Prabhupada defines here Krishna consciousness, which is the goal of the different yoga processes, which is explained in the middle six chapters, as the steady concentration of the mind upon Krishna. So there shouldn't be any problem of steadily thinking about Krishna. There shouldn't be, but of course there is. And this has been explained throughout the Bhagavad Gita. Even in the sixth chapter, Arjuna was saying, after Krishna described the yoga system, one of the first things Arjuna said after Krishna described it is, Arjuna vacha yoyam yoga toya prokta samyena madhusudana etasyam napashami chanchala dvasti tings diram chanchalam himanat krishna pramati balavadridam tasyam nigrahamanye vayor eva sudiskram. My dear Krishna, the system of yoga, which you have summarized, appears to be unendurable to me. For the mind is restless and unsteady. The mind is restless, unsteady, and very strong, O Krishna. And to subdue it, it seems mind, O Arjuna, but it's possible by suitable practice and by detachment. Asamya tatmana yoga. Dush prapya iti memiti asatma. If one whose mind is unbridled, self-realization is difficult work, but he who strives by appropriate means is a sure success. Now the question is, what does that appropriate mean? In the third chapter, second chapter, Krishna has more or less gone over all the different means, and he summarized it as, at the end of the second chapter, Apremana Machala Pratishtam Samudram Apa Pradishanti Advat Tadvat Kamayam Pradishanti Sarve Tashantim Apnoti Nakama Kami. That a person is not disturbed by the incessant flow of desires that enter like rivers into the ocean, which is always being filled but is always still, and alone achieve peace, and not the person who strives to satisfy such desires. So the word is used, kama-kami, a person who desires to fulfill desires. In other words, there is two things involved. There is the desires arising out of our past conditioning, and then there is the person who's desiring, the soul. One is a situation arising out of past karma. For instance, the material world is princely. Principle of bondage is called avidya, ignorance. So everyone in the material world is in ignorance, otherwise they wouldn't be in the material world. And from avidya, when many things come, one of them is generally called bija. Bija means sinful desire. Sinful desire generally, as we analyze avidya a little differently, we start with bijam and papam and parabdha and aparabdha karma. It's also analyzed as asmita, false ego. In other words, when we're in ignorance, we don't know who we are, then we accept a false identity in relation to this world, this body and mind is our identity. That's called asmita. And along with whatever body and mind we get, there is dvesha and Rag and dvesha. We have a built-in conditioning to become attached to certain things, be averse to other things. So as soon as we are conditioned by avidya, we get false ego, and along with that, so many likes and dislikes. And then abhinivesha. We become absorbed in material consciousness and are always in anxiety about our impending annihilation. Not a very bargain, but this is what we got. This is more or less what became to enjoy in the material world. And the other way of analyzing is that this bijam, this seed, which is can be also considered the whole collection, sinful desires, rag and dvesha, asmita, they all produce this bija, this desire. The principal desire is I want to enjoy, I want to be the lord of the material energy, and I want to enjoy the material energy. So most people would think, oh, that's not very simple, that's just natural. But unfortunately, the laws of material nature don't agree. So we may think I'm a very nice person, I help old ladies across the street, I stop at the traffic lights, and I pay my taxes, and how can I be sinful? Well, the basic principle is that this world belongs to God. We may not like it. We may think that that's, you know, why is he so greedy? Why doesn't he share his wealth with others? Why does it have to just belong to him? Well, actually, it doesn't have to belong to him. The problem is we don't believe it belongs to him at all. Just like you can find a car on the street, and you don't see the owner, you just hop in and take it for a drive. Well, why shouldn't I do it? There's no one else is using it. Well, unfortunately, the police won't agree with you. You'll be arrested. You may claim that, you know, it was just in the street. No one claimed anything. I shouted out, if anyone wants the car, please come take it. So certainly the world looks pretty innocent. We're just walking around. No one seems to be doing much with it. So we just grab a thing here and there. Call it Australia or kick out a few aborigines. How can that be sinful? Well, the laws of nature act in such a way that as soon as jayato vishayam punsam sangas te shupajayate, sangat sanjayate kama, kama krodo vijayate. That as soon as we start thinking that I am the Lord here, we don't have to think, well, you know, I own it, I have the contract for it, it's legally in my name, so how can that be sinful? The government, you know, I'm recognized, this is my property. Well, there is a police force besides the Australian police force. It's called Maya. And Maya always gets her man or woman. And as soon as one even starts to think about stealing Krishna's property, then at once one is arrested by Maya. And the prison, we're all walking around in our prison. We may think that this is a wonderful, beautiful body, but according to the report coming from Maya, from Krishna, this body itself is the prison. and it's given to us to suffer different types of miseries. Or, if we agree to utilize in Krishna service, then gradually we're put on probation. But in any case, this body itself is a prison we've been put into to suffer, or so-called enjoy. And it begins with simply looking over the creation and trying to figure out what's mine and how I can get more and how I can avoid losing what I have and enjoy it. So it's called Vyayato, and then Kam, then Krodha, then Lova, then Moha, and Smriti, Brahmasad, and Guri Nashat. So these things all happen. We lose our, we become lusty and greedy and angry. We become bewildered. We forget what reality is. This is all part of how the material nature works. And this is all because we're in ignorance, and therefore we have so many desires we identify with, and the result of that is papa, sinful activities. It is not that we simply walk around with all kinds of sinful desires, but we don't do any of it. We've got to do something, and anything we do outside of Krishna consciousness is called papa. We may choose which type of sinful activity I want to perform. Some people think activities that are sinful in the mode of ignorance are not very good. But sinful activities in the mode of passion, they're worthy of becoming praised. And other people think, oh, both these people are sinful, you know, we're in goodness, and everyone else is a demon. But actually, anyone in the material world who's not performing his activities of Krishna is more or less sinful, more or less. And the result of any sinful activity is called aparabdha karma. So aparabdha karma means that as soon as we do something, our store of sinful reactions increases. What we have waiting for us in the future is just, we've added a little bit more to it. And some of it may manifest immediately called parabdha karma. And others, and along with that comes, it's called kutam. We increase our sinful proclivity to do the same thing again. It's not that I have some sinful desire, I execute it, and that's it. Now we go on to bigger and better things. Now I perform some sinful activity, and there's a reaction that's manifested immediately. Some reaction is stored up, and some manifests itself as a proclivity to do that same thing again in the future. And that turns into bijam at some particular state. And then we continue on, just increasing our sinful desires, sinful activities, sinful reactions, and sinful proclivities. Doesn't sound very hopeful. Therefore, the way out is not by... Well, the way out, there may be many ways out. One can stop sinful activities, but the problem is we may not stop sinful desire, which is the root. Actually, the root is vidya. The root is we don't know who we are, and therefore we don't know really what we're supposed to do in order to become happy. But we think ourselves to be this body, therefore we think that happiness, Maya tells us, happiness will be in sinful activities. And unfortunately it doesn't work like that. But anyhow, when we're in ignorance, we don't know that. We don't have any alternative. We might as well try that out because we have nothing else to do. And we do the same thing again and again. So, if there's a contest in the world for fool number one, everyone in the material world more or less comes in first. Because only fool number one would do the same thing again and again, knowing it's not going to work, but doing it anyhow. So that's called maya. So here are the solution to the problem that Krishna is recommending. In the third chapter, there's a gradual solution. In other words, there are different levels of knowledge which produce different types of renunciation. So So one level of knowledge is karma yoga, that we have to do our duty. Now, just to do one's duty in the material world is more or less handing back part of the stolen property. You know, these are activities. We're giving it back. We're dedicating them to the proprietor. It's not the whole thing, because we still don't really recognize the proprietor. We still don't really want to dovetail even ourselves. We don't want to admit that we're actually the supreme proprietor's servants. But we're willing to cooperate with him. It's like a business deal. He'll get some of the reward and we get the other part. So, but at least there's some recognition that we have an obligation to the proprietor. We pay our rent and he doesn't kick us out. So that's more or less karma yoga. We pay our rent, the rain comes, you turn the tap, the water comes, the light shines, the wind blows, everyone's cool. But then, in the fourth chapter, Krishna says that there is a little bit more than that. That's alright, now you're peacefully situated, You don't have to worry about where you get your next meal and everything seems alright. But then the next thing is that when our mind's a little bit more peaceful, then we can begin to understand things a little bit better. At least doing karma yoga, there's some acknowledgement to higher powers that we're obligated to fulfill the laws of nature, to follow them. But transcendental knowledge means that actually there is a God and he's a person. And it's not that there is some just impersonal Vishnu or there are so many different choices of who I want to worship, but there's actually a God and that we're actually servants of that God. So that's transcendental knowledge. We're spiritual beings and that there's actually a person, that it's not that I have a choice whether or not to serve him. We're always servants of him. I have a choice whether I want to recognize him or not. And then in the fifth chapter, Krishna explains about, ultimately, that what the vision of a person who works acknowledges. And he sums it up that the person sees everything as his property, Krishna's property. He does everything for Krishna's pleasure. And he knows that ultimately Krishna is the real well-wisher of everyone. So he sees everyone as being part of Krishna's family and he works according to his desire. In the sixth chapter, the more practical purpose of that is further explained, that ultimately he thinks about Krishna. There is a process by which one can not only know Krishna, Vishnu, but one is actually becoming more and more conscious of Krishna through a process of yoga. So now Krishna's beginning the seventh chapter, and he's talking about what is the most practical way of meditating on Krishna, or even going through all those different levels. So here Krishna says that the best thing to do is to hear about him. That if we hear this philosophy from the beginning and understand how we're all eternally servants of Krishna, and that if we do something to please Krishna, then we'll think of Krishna, and that's all we have to do. Rather than going through all the different types of varieties, prescribed duties, and cultivation of knowledge, and meditation, learning meditation, one can come to that platform just by rendering devotional service to Krishna, beginning with hearing. Because it's not such an easy process, because generally speaking, we'd rather hear about ourselves rather than hearing about God. We'd rather find out how great we are. But actually, if you hear this philosophy, you'll find out that we're all insignificant, which is quite depressing for most of us. Not only we're insignificant, but we're constitutionally insignificant. That the person who's giving the lecture, big pep talk, don't worry, you're insignificant, but we got the formula, and one day you'll become a little less than insignificant. No, we're constitutionally always insignificant, and we'll always be insignificant. And there's no one who can make us any more significant than we already are. So for some of us, it's not so bad because we're already pretty insignificant. But we had a slight hope that maybe there would be some improvement in my insignificance. No, actually, we're 1/10,000th the size of the tip of hair in size, and we don't get any real bigger. Irrelevantly bigger. But of course, that doesn't mean that everyone in the spiritual world is all depressed and walking around with their heads bowed down low and thinking, wow, just insignificant. No, we're constitutionally tiny in relation to Krishna, but in the spiritual world, everything is based upon love. And since Krishna is the most loving, he loves everyone. Therefore, being significant or insignificant, these things are not really so much of a factor there. Because in relation to love, everyone is significant. In other words, when you actually love someone, then everyone appears very significant and you always feel insignificant. Even the most significant persons in the spiritual world, the more significant that they are, the less they feel themselves significant. And even Krishna, who is unlimitedly significant, he also feels himself quite insignificant. So we're in good company, feeling insignificant. In other words, Radharani thinks herself the most fallen devotee, and that she thinks all the other devotees are much more exalted than she is. She doesn't, you know, walk around, I'm the only one significant around here, watch out. No one offends me and gets away with it. You've heard of the material world, right? No, she actually feels herself the most insignificant. And Krishna himself, he thinks everyone else in the spiritual world is much more significant than he is. Therefore, it's not bad to feel oneself insignificant in relation to Krishna. But we don't know Krishna so well. We don't know what he's like, what his mood is, what the mood of the residents of Vrindavan are. All we see in the material world where everyone's competing with each other, trying to become significant, and some people seem more significant in relation to wealth and fame and beauty and knowledge and all these other things, and we think, wow, they're having a good time. Maybe I can be like that too, and then I can have a good time too. And then naturally we start thinking, well, what does it take to get to that position that they're in? And that's what most people are hearing about. You know, how to make $1 million in 3 weeks. And if you got to drag it out, it may take 4. You know, how to learn Bengali. They had these books in 1 month. Or Sanskrit in 3 weeks. You find them in India. How to last. It usually takes, you know, 30 years to learn Sanskrit. You buy this book, you can learn, you know, for 3 rupees. You can learn it in 6 weeks. So generally people want to do something, become more important in the material world. And that's the only place where we can become so-called more and more important. And that's generally what we're interested in. We want to hear about that. Just like most people aren't flocking to the Hare Krishna temple to find out how insignificant they are. And how they're eternally servants. You know, people's conception of servant is someone says, excuse me, can you get some water? And you go, yes, boss, yes, boss. Jump in the air, how high, boss, how high? So most people are not really enthusiastic. Matter of fact, the more independent they feel, the more they think they're independent, free to do whatever they want, the more they think they're, you know, actually showing their personality. Although the material energy is telling them to jump, that as they're just being directed by the illusory energy and everything they're doing, it's not that they're independent. They're free to do whatever they want. They're free to do whatever the latest commercial on television is telling them to do. But because of illusion, we don't understand. Therefore, we have to understand the philosophy or hear it thoroughly enough that we can become convinced that I don't really have a choice in the sense that I can become completely independent. That it's me who is directing the world. No, everyone's servant to their circumstances. And under the circumstances, Krishna is supplying us intelligence, whatever intelligence we deserve, whatever intelligence we desire, in order to work in this world. And those who are more fortunate, they try to get intelligence by which they can understand how to work in devotion in this world, and free from the aspiration to somehow or another either improve their material situation or try to avoid having their material situation become any more inauspicious than it already is. So of course, hearing about Krishna doesn't mean that suddenly we give up all desires to maintain the body, and you know, we just walk down the street chanting our rounds, and a car comes by and we think, well, you know, I'm not supposed to improve my situation, so I shouldn't avoid the car running over me. And I'm laying on the street after the car ran over me, so I shouldn't really call an ambulance or ask anyone to do such a thing, because I don't want to improve my situation. Just keep on chanting. No, it's not so impractical. The idea is, that life's desires should never be, one should, kamasyanendriya pritira loba, loba, labo, jivita yavata, jignasyata jignasya, narto yas cheya karmavi. That one's desire should not be aimed at sense gratification, but one should only desire a healthy life, self-preservation. That one should aim for self-realization, and in order to achieve that, one needs a healthy life. But one doesn't have to simply hear about how to accumulate more and more material paraphernalia. One should try to live simply as possible, and at the same time try to develop one's Krishna consciousness. So, Krishna is saying, hear from me, how by practicing yoga, how to practice yoga. So yoga can be practiced, if we hear from Krishna, in many varieties of different occupations, many different activities. It's not that it's limited to just a few activities. Everything can be utilized in Krishna's service. So Prabhupada writes, endeavor executed with intelligence in Krishna consciousness is called enthusiasm, that the devotees know how to dovetail everything in Krishna's service. So it's not that we have to restrain or restrict our activities, we just have to find out how to appropriately utilize everything in Krishna's service. Then we can become enthusiastic in whatever we're doing in Krishna consciousness. So we have to do something, it has to be done with intelligence, with knowledge, and that endeavor and intelligence should facilitate our remembering Krishna, and the result is that we should feel enlivened and enlightened by becoming progressively more and more conscious of Krishna. And that means we can utilize so many things in Krishna's service. So Krishna will explain this in this chapter. He'll begin by saying, Rasoham Asnu Kondiya. It's not that Krishna's service is only in some other world beyond our perception, and that you begin to understand, you know, after you leave the body and go up to some cloud in the sky, then your service begins when he gives you a horn or a harp to play. And then you sit there forever playing the same old tune. Wishing that you would have been gone to hell and where they have rock music and... You know, kind of more exciting life. No, one can actually in this lifetime, one has to in this lifetime engage one's energies, whatever one has in Krishna's service. One's propensities, one's abilities, all these things can be dovetailed in Krishna's service under proper direction, and then one can actually become more and more Krishna conscious in whatever we're doing. But it has to be some bona fide activity done with a proper understanding in Krishna consciousness, and then we can utilize so many things in Krishna service, practically everything. So Krishna will explain that. Rasoham Apsana Kondiya, the water, it's not that we stop drinking water, but when we drink water, we remember that this is Krishna's energy. that it's not that we stop activity, but we add a meditation to it. When we see the sun, we remember it's Krishna's energy. It's Krishna's sun. So it's not stopping seeing, it's not blinding ourselves to the sun, that it's all Maya here. No, we see it in relation to Krishna. And the energies that are within our possessions, and we utilize those for Krishna's service. So everything, smelling the earth, we remember it's Krishna's, the smell of the earth is Krishna's, is Krishna, the light and the sun and the moon, the building that people have is coming from Krishna, but this is all meditation on Krishna. So one can meditate upon Krishna and all the different phases of one's life. And this is called Krishna consciousness. So Krishna recommends this as the most practical and easy yoga to perform, that one can connect, ultimately connect with Krishna simply by the process of hearing, and then if we hear enough and become convinced that whatever we have belongs to Him and utilize it for Him, then that meditation will become more and more steady and more profound, and that's called Krishna consciousness. So it's not that we have to change who we are, change what we're doing. We just have to accept who we really are, what's really going on here. And if we do that, then we become more and more Krishna conscious. Sometimes we think that, you know, if only I was born 3 inches higher, the devotional service would be easier. You know, if I had a different body or a different propensity or whatever, that if only I was, or if I could collect more money, then I'm, Krishna would be more pleased with me, or certainly, I'd be able to pay for my ticket back to the spiritual sky quicker. But it doesn't quite work like that. It's utilizing whatever talent we have, and we utilize that in Krishna's service, then the result is that we should be able to think of Krishna more easily and spontaneously. It's not that we're going to walk around, trying to memorize Krishna, with a little book in our hands. Excuse me, Krishna. Where are you from anyhow? Krishna, Krishna. Not that it's going to always be great difficulty, inconceivable how we have to memorize Krishna at every step of our lives and not forget He's the sun and the moon and the rain and so many different things. No, if we actually follow the process intelligently, if we hear properly, then it should become natural and spontaneous, gradually. That gradually our realization will be there, how everything actually is Krishna's energy, how we are actually Krishna's servants, and it's not a horrible thing. It's not like the worst thing in the world to find out that you're actually Krishna's servant. And most people think like that it's not the most horrible thing in the world to be das, that it's actually quite nice. So we begin to realize that, then we feel more comfortable as das and less comfortable being in Maya. In the beginning, Maya seems, we've been accustomed to Maya, we're afraid, what it would be like to get on the spiritual platform. Is it a shaky platform? If I take, the wrong step, I can fall back into some unknown platform. No, gradually, as a spiritual platform is revealed, then we feel more comfortable there. Just like when we were younger, we couldn't conceive of giving up our stuffed teddy bear. If anyone took it away from us, we'd cry. Nothing could seem worse. But, now you can't even remember which was the stuffed teddy bear that you were most attached to. So, similarly, as we grow up in Krishna consciousness and become more attached to Krishna and to pleasing Krishna, and all these things that we thought we couldn't give up at first, all these different, especially subtle attachments or even gross attachments, we can't even remember which they are. Because if we think about them long enough, trying to remember, Krishna will probably help us. But after a while, one just naturally forgets about it, and remembering Krishna becomes more spontaneous. And the process, again, is just mentioned here, as Krishna says, just to hear about Krishna regularly. Hear about Krishna, in such a way as we actually try to put into practice something practical. That is, utilize our energies more and more in His service, especially in such a way as that we're able to hear and chant better. That if we can organize our lives in such a way as that we hear and chant more consistently throughout the whole day, and that we're able to remember Krishna much more easily, then that's the proper use of our intelligence. That's proper organization. And then by doing that, remembrance of Krishna becomes natural and spontaneous. And then one finds it very difficult to forget Krishna. Just like the gopis were complaining that Krishna has left us, he's ran away, he's now enjoying with the city girls, he's forgotten about us. We would like to forget about the rascal, but we can't do it. We've been trying to figure out how to forget about the guy, but we can't just do it. So the gopis said, Krishna may be happy forgetting about us, but we can't be happy forgetting about him. So we're trying to come to that stage, where we can't forget Krishna. So that's what Krishna is explaining about here, beginning with hearing and practicing what Krishna says, how do we can actually realize him more, and that if we practice like that, then we'll remember him more. So are there any questions, comments? So that Jnana Yoga means that. There may be a tendency towards impersonalism, both in Karma Yoga and in Jnana Yoga. Because Karma Yoga probably defines as when there's less attachment, when there's less knowledge and less renunciation. That is, one's performing one's prescribed duty. Now, what the conception is of the person who's performing Karma Yoga may vary. One may have, just like Prabhupada writes in the 10th chapter, that generally Karma Yoga, we take it, that one knows the goal is Krishna, but one is addicted to the fruits of one's work. Then he defines Jnana Yoga as one knows that one takes pleasure in mental speculation to understand Krishna. Then he defines Bhakti Yoga as one seeks Krishna completely in consciousness of Krishna. That's called Bhakti Yoga. So it's not inherent that Karma Yoga and Jnana Yoga or even Astanga Yoga is necessarily impersonal, although it may be. Just like there's Naich Karma Yoga, which is without desire for the fruit. So the conception may be either in impersonalism or in Paramatma or in Bhagavan. It's not necessarily impersonal. Depends who you're hearing from, who you're associating with. But generally the Vanashram system, Daivi Vanasha, the conception is personal. But then we have, you know, Karma Yoga also, according to one's particular conception. But yoga generally means something personal, Krishna. Karma, when we think of karma, doing good karma, then it's generally, then it may be for just getting some fruit of result. So those who are doing karma to some fruit of result, or on the gross platform, they worship. They're in Anamaya, and I think they worship. There is Durga. They're generally Durga worshippers. And on the most subtle Pranamaya platform, they're worshippers of Surya. And then on the Manamaya platforms, they're worshippers of Ganapati. And then on the worship on Vijnanamaya, they're worshippers of Lord Shiva. And on the worship of Anandamaya, there are worshippers of Vishnu. So according to the mode of nature, one is executing karma and following one's prescribed duty, one may be attracted to different deities to get different results. But when we get to karma yoga, generally there's a conception of Krishna. And then Jnana Yoga and so on. Generally the there should be a conception of Krishna, that Krishna is the goal. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. Grantharaj, Bhagavad Gita, Kujai, Srila Prabhupada, Kujai.